You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm David Kleon. I'm a former editor for this website and also for Al Jazeera America and World Politics Review. And these days, I'm a freelance writer and political risk consultant. I tweet a lot at David Kleon. And I'm here, and I'm in Brooklyn, New York, in my apartment, which you can see behind me, complete with a Ben Shahn drawing, not an original, I don't think. I'm here with Daniel Bessner, who is in Seattle. Daniel, why don't you introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Hello, David. My name is Daniel Bessner, as you just said, and I'm the Anne H. H. and Kenneth B. Pyle Assistant Professor in American Foreign Policy at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, which is quite a title. But basically, I study the intellectual history of foreign policy, and I am in sunny Seattle.
Yeah, I think I actually walked around that campus a few years ago on my first trip to Seattle, and I remember seeing a bust of Scoop Jackson, who...
Who
my understanding is kind of... kind of an ironic figure for you to be in the school of, because he's considered kind of like a proto neoconservative figure, right? And that's not at all.
Yeah, no, I am certainly not a neoconservative figure. Scoop's a really interesting character in that he really is sort of the bridge between 50s, 60s Cold War liberalism and 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s neoconservatism. Many of the most famous neoconservatives, particularly Richard Perle, were on his staff, and he was associated with other people like Paul Wolfowitz. So right. He's a critical bridge from liberalism to neoconservatism. And yes, and we do have a bust in front of our school, and actually his papers are contained here. So we are the Scoop Jackson School. Yeah.
But as we're going to get into in due course, that's really not how you would identify in terms of your own foreign policy views, which you've been outspoken about. I feel like I should let you characterize those, not me.
Yeah, well, I would say I'm very skeptical of the American imperial project as I see it's been going on since 1945, and really even earlier, but it sort of has been on steroids since 45, when the United States emerged as a global hegemon. And while I would admit that maybe in the 50s or the 60s, I could see some reasons for why someone would want to believe in the beautiful dream to some degree of the American empire, I think the history of the past 70 or so years has really demonstrated the degree to which it has not been able to effectively achieve its own goals, its liberal internationalist goals, more multilateral, or its more neoconservative goals. So I'm skeptical of the project as it's currently conceived. Not that I would say that I want to retreat to an isolationism or anything along those lines, but what I'm really interested in is in developing a left-wing understanding of the United States' role in the world, and seeing whether it's possible to pursue a strategy of something that I've come to call, in sort of a lame coinage, involvement without imperialism, and what that might look like. But it's very much the beginnings of a thought process for myself and a bunch of other thinkers who might identify as being on the broad left wing.
Yeah, and I think later in this conversation, we'll get to that at some length. I did want to say that those are roughly my own views, too. And I think they also are roughly the views of the creator of Blogging Heads, Bob Wright, my former boss, who I'm sure will listen to this at some point. Hi, Bob. And who's always wanted to sort of create what he calls the progressive realist space, which I think would align with what you're describing. And also a mutual friend of ours, who I think you've collaborated with, Stephen Wertheim, is another who, by the way, everyone should follow me, Daniel, and Stephen, and Bob, but I'm sure you all do already. Stephen is another scholar about our age who also has written about basically, in some ways, a revisionist understanding of the isolationist movement in the period leading up to Pearl Harbor. I mean, his view is basically that they've kind of been cast in retrospect as a bunch of Lindberghian proto-alt-right neo-Nazis, and many of them were, but that there was also a genuine, you know, humanistic anti-war movement that basically has been forgotten to history, although obviously you can see it resurgent during the Vietnam War protests and the Iraq War protests, and to some extent even today, but sort of keeping alive that tradition, I think, of left criticism of imperialism is a really important project. So,
yeah, absolutely. And just as you mentioned, Stephen and I co-wrote an article for the Foreign Affairs website that essentially criticized think tanks for not taking their potentially at least democratic role more seriously and engaging the public in their own debates. And what my own work focuses on is the development of the modern think tank and what brought intellectuals into the sphere of wanting to affect foreign policy. And I essentially argue it's really linked to the 1930s and intellectuals' confrontation with first fascism and then in the 40s Soviet communism, and the belief that only an epistocracy or only an elite of intellectuals and decision makers can make foreign policy in light of the historical situation where the quote unquote masses, which is a term that they use to understand the public, in their minds at least, voted for Hitler or supported Hitler and supported retrograde policies. So it's all linked together. And I think both Stephen and I believe that we can make our foreign policy making process more democratic and that it would be more legitimate in that sense and in fact might transcend imperialism, even though we could get into a long discussion about how that might be accomplished. And whether it's a pipe dream,
and I think we will. But I think we should talk about the most immediate news first, and then we were going to talk about an article you wrote, and then I think we'll get back to that. So, okay. So we're recording this on Thursday. What is the day? It's June 8th. Thursday, June 8th, in the late afternoon, and this morning, both of us, like pretty much everyone who cares about politics, even a little bit, watched the Senate Intelligence Committee hearings in which former FBI Director James Comey testified about why he is the former FBI director and not the current one. We just kind of wanted to reflect on that while it's still fresh in our minds. Neither of us is particularly an expert on Comey or this investigation, but we're following it. So, Daniel, what were your overall impressions? I mean, who are the, as Chris Salissa of The Fix would say, who are the winners and losers in Washington today?
Well, it's interesting that it's sort of framed in that perspective, right? Because that just implies a very short-term way of thinking about it, the winners and the losers, which is what the media, the current media environment lends itself toward.
What are you implying about Chris Salissa, who was paid eight figures by CNN? Are you suggesting that he's not like providing a real service to news consumers?
I think he's fantastic and he should have me on. I mean, otherwise, but right. I think it's brilliant. But but I think it that's sort of the least interesting question in some regards. So I'm no legal expert, but I talked to a couple of my friends who are lawyers and I read some Lawfare, which is a great blog website, Lawfare. And it seems to me that it's pretty clear that there's direct evidence that Trump obstructed justice, right? He clearly tried to get Comey not to investigate Flynn and then admitted it on television.
I was going to say the direct evidence would be when he, gave a TV interview with Lester Holt and said that was, pretty much exactly what he was trying to do was obstruct justice.
So, and to some degree, it's not even interesting. He did obstruct justice. What's interesting to see, from my non-legal, non-expert perspective, it appears to me that he obstructed justice.
That's certainly the opinion of Jeffrey Toobin and most other mainstream legal commentators. Yeah, it's not a reach, really.
Right. It's not a reach. So what's interesting is watching all these Republicans who clearly don't like Trump, like McCain, sort of go to bat for him. Mm-hmm. Right. And what does that say about the present state of the Republican Party and the present state of our national security discourse, but also the present state of the executive? Right. So the executive has been increasing power really for the last 200 years, but especially for the last 70 years, and especially in foreign policy making situations, but also in domestic policy. And so there's this natural obeisance that people, congressmen specifically and congressmen of a specific political party, pay to the president. So the interesting question is, what are these guys who are really staking their reputations to some degree, especially someone like McCain, who's not going to be around forever and is going to have history books written about him, staking their historical reputations on Trump?
Yeah, so I agree with all that. And I would say, as far as my impressions of the Comey hearings today, that I thought he came off really well. I thought that in some ways it felt like that was the point of the thing, was for Comey to salvage some of his reputation, which took such a beating last year, you know, especially among kind of Democrats and centrist figures, you know, because he was seen, and there is a legitimate case to make that Nate Silver has, you know, continued to make, that he really did play some decisive role in why Hillary Clinton lost the election. And I think, you know, all the reporting has sort of indicated that while he'll never say he made a mistake or would change anything, that he doesn't feel great about having had that impact, or about, you know, how he's seen as a result. So I think he really he wanted to be, you know, kind of seen in a better light. And I think he really succeeded. I think that, you know, among liberals, among kind of mainstream commentators, the statement that he put out yesterday or the day before, you know, kind of outlining his interactions with Trump, a lot of people were hailing as like a good piece of writing. And then he just comes across as a very affable, you know, personal, honest guy. And I tweeted something during the hearing to the effect of like, you know, he seemed like someone who took Trump as an affront to decency.
Right, which is very interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, normally I would say, normally, like, you know, some years back, I would say that, you know, when you get this appealing, telegenic, honest-seeming everyman denouncing the president of the United States as a liar under oath at a Senate hearing, that does not bode well for the president of the United States. That seems like a pretty big deal. However, as we know, nothing matters. And you were saying earlier that the Republicans, and you were saying kind of on national security issues, but really just on all fronts, the Republicans are kind of willing to cover up basically anything for Trump. I mean, there is no, and we've known this since, you know, at least the general election, that there's basically nothing Trump can say or do or be accused of that will cause more than, you know, among actual elected Republicans, as opposed to, you know, conservative intellectuals or consultants who style themselves never Trump, or retired figures like in the Bush family, but among elected Republicans, there's essentially nothing that that Trump can say or do that will cause them to do more than maybe complain that he's, you know, that he's being distracting, or that they're very concerned, or something like that. I mean, that's the kind of John McCain or Ben Sasse approach.
Yes.
Do you get any sense, based on anything that happened today or around today, that might change in light of the Comey testimony, or are we where we've always been?
It's hard. I mean, first of all, everything's hard to know. And as a historian, I'm always loath to predict things, because when you predict things, you get things wrong, as everyone knows about the Hillary Clinton electoral prospects. But I think it's interesting to focus on this, not only from Republicans are venal and they just want to be in power perspective, but also from the fact that to some degree there's a structural incentive to always support the executive, because the executive is by far, right now at least, the most powerful branch of government. So right. Even if it's a member of your party who you don't like, and I don't think someone like McCain particularly likes Trump, it would be giving up an enormous degree of power to really go against him. Now, the question of whether this will actually affect something going forward, I mean, it's hard to know, because we always think about politicians as being affected by power positions and their electoral prospects, and that's true. But then the question is, on some level, is Trump so extreme? Is what he has been doing so extreme that even if you want your team to win for the good of the country, you just can't allow an issue, something like this to go on. Someone with this, these sorts of personality dynamics, someone who is frankly so shockingly ignorant of the office that he spent, a year and a half running for, to continue in office, which could have grave effects, like you said, not only for American national security, but for the country as a whole. I think it's hard to know, you know, within hours of the testimony, but I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing some people start to break ranks as the 2018 elections come up, and it seems that the Democrats might have a hope of taking back Congress. That's my take on it and that perspective. But I also think it's really important to focus for a second on why Comey was received with such rapture among liberals. And I think it's important to recognize that a lot of the security architecture, the National Security Council, the FBI and its powers, the CIA, was actually created to a large degree over the course of the 20s and the 50s, 20s to the 50s, roughly by liberals, or what before that when they were called progressives. So it's not surprising, at least, when someone who seems upstanding, like you said, a good citizen, a good guy like Comey, takes the stand and really defends the FBI, that liberals would cheer him, because an element of these institutions is really to protect democracy from itself. So with the FBI, for example, ginning up charges against, you know, Muslim terrorists throughout the nation and things like that, and really performing, I would say, pretty ethically awful and also strategically useless activities, they would still support someone like Comey.
Or, you know, spying on Martin Luther King's sex life and black and stuff like that. But
So I mean, this is to some degree inherent in 20th century liberalism as it's developed out of the progressive movement, with a deep skepticism of the people writ large, and wanting to give these sorts of prerogative powers to institutions like the FBI or the NSC or the CIA. And I think that's something that liberalism as instantiated in the Democratic Party, it really needs to confront going forward, especially given the revelations of the post-Patriot Act, post-USA Freedom Act United States, when these institutions have really overstepped their bounds. And it's kind of sad, and really, in a real way, anti-democratic, in a sense that it's not subject to democratic oversight in either a formal or nominal sense, that so many liberals have cheered just because he seems to be a good guy.
And it's an anecdote, but I do think, just to sort of make that a little more real than it might sometimes feel on Twitter or whatever, I chose this morning to find a populated place to watch these hearings instead of just, you know, streaming it on my laptop at home. And I went to, I looked up this sort of coffee shop / bar, very kind of bohemian aesthetic, in Borum Hill, which is a kind of one of the classic brownstone neighborhoods of central Brooklyn, a neighborhood that went entirely for Hillary Clinton, you know, by big margins. And, if it's similar to Park Slope or Brooklyn Heights or anywhere like that. So I went there, and it was this sort of packed space. And about half the people there, I would say, were journalists covering it, including the team from Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. They're supposed to broadcast tomorrow. I declined to sign a release. I don't want to be mocked.
I want to be associated.
No, it's not even that.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's just that I don't want to be taken out of context, let's say. But in any case, I was really struck. So this is a crowd that's in some cases drinking early in the morning on a Thursday, clearly a very well-educated, well-to-do bourgeois liberal crowd. And when Comey would say things like, you know, this isn't about any one party, this is about America, or when he would defend the FBI, because he gave this this whole spiel early on about, you know, how he was sad he never really got to say goodbye to the workers at the FBI, that, you know, because he got fired in such a ridiculous way and so abruptly. And so he sort of took this opportunity to do that and to praise their work and to talk about them in these very glowing Aaron Sorkin style, like the system works, institutions are good, hardworking, right, patriotic people in them kind of way. And I will tell you, the crowd I was with, they clapped, they cheered,
right,
they shouted things in support. I mean, this is real. This is like, this is the kind of thing that I, you know, because I tend to hang out with a more kind of young left, like academic and journalistic circles who make fun of stuff like this. But I often feel like we're making fun of abstractions, or we're making fun of certain ridiculous Twitter personalities or politicians. But no, like there are definitely real people. And I know this, having grown up in Washington, D.C., in Northwest D.C., in the Maryland suburbs. This is a real species, the West Wing liberal. That
Well, because... Well, the system has worked for them, right? It's really a lack of empathy more than anything else, because for them, the system has worked. Their parents weren't detained under false pretenses for being illegal immigrants. No one that they know died in Iraq for the most part. You know, the entire system has worked for them. And especially in a place like New York, which is really, I'm from New York, I love New York, but it's really an ecosystem unto itself, and there's no need to really leave. So when you're just ensconced in Park Slope and everyone you see is pretty much like you, it makes sense that you would have faith in these institutions because they worked for you. And obviously, I'm not the first person to say this, and probably not the 7,000th person to say this, but this is why the election came as such a shock to all of these people, right? And what's interesting to see is that even after the wake of such a transitional moment where the emperor really has been shown to have no clothes, people still, or the people you're describing, still seem to have faith in these institutions. And that's what's really interesting. And I wonder, there could be a lot of reasons for that, like we said, related to media diet and issues along those lines. But it doesn't seem like that could last. I know we're within months of the Trump inauguration, and of course, we're within a little longer of the election. But I don't see how possibly this faith in institutions, this strident post-Cold War faith in institutions, could possibly last going forward amongst liberals. And it's really interesting is that so most of the critique of the institutions, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to come almost primarily from the left, not liberalism. Like liberalism is in no way really seeking to reform itself, which wasn't always true historically. You know, you go back to the 30s and there's liberal critiques of New Deal efforts, 40s, 50s, the same thing. But it seems now that liberalism has become so, is decadent the right word?
You know what, I'll push back a little bit. I think it's certainly possible to see in a publication like The New Yorker, which, you know, I don't think anyone would deny is a bourgeois liberal publication, or in something like Ta-Nehisi Coates' work, you know, I mean, he's writing for The Atlantic, writing best-selling books, getting MacArthur grants, and the implications of some of his work, you know, can seem quite damning to the liberal project. But you sort of have to speak within a context and in a language where, like, I think there are a lot of bourgeois liberals who are aware, for instance, that, you know, that our current course on climate is unsustainable and dramatic changes are going to be made, and who can get very, very upset at, you know, conservatives who want to reverse that, at Trump pulling out of Paris last week. And, you know, we're very enthusiastic about Paris. What's harder, of course, and they might know it intellectually, but especially when they're in rear guard mode with, you know, Trump assaulting everything they believe in, what's harder is to admit, well, you know, Paris probably wasn't going to go far enough, and that the reality is to avert catastrophic climate change is going to require, you know, dramatic shifts in just about everything. And even if those shifts are politically possible, they would be incredibly disruptive to the economic status quo, to everyone's lives, as the results of not doing them will be. And so I think what I see is, you know, I mean, I grew up among bourgeois liberals. My family are bourgeois liberals.
Some of my best friends are bourgeois liberals.
No, and it's
like, true. Yeah,
literally true. And, yeah. And I, you know, so am I. I mean, I'd straddle the line.
Yeah, we're all bourgeois.
The left camp. Yeah, but like, I mean, it's very, what I found is that it's very easy, especially when the people, you know, in power at the moment are just so cartoonishly demonic and evil. It's very easy to kind of radicalize one's rhetoric, to panic, to feel anxiety. But it's actually like, I think there are a lot of people who you might consider bourgeois liberals who kind of like see the problem and can wrap their heads around the problem, but can't really conceive of doing anything truly radical to address the problem, even though it needs to be addressed in a radical way. And I've certainly found this to be, since Trump took power, I mean, since literally election night and during the transition period, I kept thinking, like, you know, what if Obama, you know, were to take radical steps to try to, you know, force the electors to not bring Trump to power? What if the deep state did all kinds of machinations? What if Democrats, you know, were on TV every day calling the Electoral College an illegitimate system and saying the will of people was being violated? Like, these all sound like, I'm not saying any of these necessarily should have been done or would have worked, and they all carried serious dangers, but like, no one even thinks that way at all. Like, faith in the, not just institutions, but norms and the way things have always worked is so deep-seated that even though we were all, I think, feeling profound terror and anxiety about Trump winning and what it would mean for the country and the world, no one actually did a single thing to stop it. We just kind of accepted that it was going to happen, and we just kind of had this. And actually, something I've wondered about a lot is I think there's a kind of lazy impulse to take the left liberal ideological spectrum, which is, you know, debates over how universal healthcare should be and stuff like that, you know, how high the minimum wage should be, and conflate them with a somewhat different spectrum, which is basically like, do you believe in kind of playing within the rules we have and trusting, you know, the fundamentally democratic nature of our system as just kind of a real and permanent thing? Or do you believe in kind of throwing out the rule book? And I've actually been struck that for all that liberals get sort of accused of being, or Democrats get accused of being like wishy-washy centrists, it's often people in that camp who've been saying, you know, really kind of like bold things about, you know, what we might do to stop this administration. And the left's attitude has generally been, nope, we got to get organized at the grassroots, got to, you know, win local offices, got to, you know, register people to vote for a left agenda. And you know, which I agree with, we absolutely do need to be doing all those things. But I've actually been struck in some ways by the left is not interested in shortcuts, let's say, for better or worse. The left is not interested in throwing out the rule book, even though they agree by and large that the Republicans have been doing that for some time. Yes. And this is where it's gotten us. So,
yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting to just a little bit to speak about liberalism. So what is the liberal utopia? Are we currently living in the liberal utopia? And I think when you examine it from a perspective like that, to many people, it would seem to be, yes, it's a sort of end of ideology discourse. And this is why, really, since the 60s with Daniel Bell, when he first wrote The End of Ideology, liberalism has evolved, or some might say, no, let's just say evolved and not devolved. Liberalism has evolved into be an ideology focusing on tweaking the current institutional architecture so that it could achieve better outcomes. And this is why people like Matt Iglesias or Ezra Klein are sort of these liberal darlings. And this is why liberalism has, to some degree, descended into wonkery. Because the major political problems of the time, the political questions of values, liberals think have essentially been answered. That there are clear answers on these questions, whether it be race, whether it be economics, whether it be foreign policy. And the issue is, how do we use the system to achieve the goals that, quote unquote, everybody agrees on? Now, right. Conservatives in the 70s began to say, no, we don't actually agree on this. And they focus much more on political organizing, both at the grassroots with evangelical conservatives, but also at the elite level with people like the Koch brothers funding liberty. Libertarian think tanks, which have actually been, I've studied this a bit in terms of my scholarly persona, have actually been remarkably successful in bringing ideas not only to policymakers, but doing things like getting high school students to read Ayn Rand. So right. in my high school, people read The Fountainhead. Why aren't people reading the Communist Manifesto? And that's because liberalism, that's a left-wing issue, but what would be a liberal text? The General Theory of Employment, you know, Keynes. Why aren't people reading Keynes. It's because liberalism has assumed that the questions of values, the questions regarding values have been answered, and so now it's just left to tweak. So to some degree, we are living in a liberal utopia. That's point one. Point two is when I think liberals say things like they don't want to, and I don't want to mean to be using liberals as a derogatory term. I think a very interesting intellectual historian, James Livingston from Rutgers, has said that the left needs liberals, and I would direct people to the Society for United States Intellectual History blog with a great conversation between James Livingston and Andrew Hartman where they discuss this in depth. But I think the left does need liberals for a real way. But I also think the radical rhetoric, or the seemingly radical rhetoric that comes from liberalism, from liberals, is much more of a posture than it is anything else. So I don't truly think that liberals think Trump is an existential threat. So I've written about this in the magazine.
Do you think that Trump is an existential threat?
No.
I often do.
I don't think Trump is an existential
Well, let's get back to that in a sec. But you were saying.
Sure. So I was just saying, I think really since the 40s, people who self-identify as liberalism have used what's termed the Weimar analogy, the idea that the United States is Weimar, the Weimar Republic, 1918 to 1933 preceded Hitler. And the sense that the United States is Weimar and whatever political leader, whether it be LBJ initially in the 60s, then Nixon, and today Trump, is Hitler. And what actually worries me, and I co-wrote this piece in Jacobin with a Dartmouth professor, a good friend of mine named Udi Greenberg, is that this analogy has actually been used to impose what I would say are anti-democratic policies. So in the late 1940s and 1950s, people are worried about the Soviet Union being analogous to the Nazis. So they institute the National Security Council, where people aren't confirmed. That's, of course, where Kissinger gets into the government through the National Security Council, through no oversight, the CIA, even in organizations like think tanks, which essentially remove the people from democratic policymaking. And this was made to a large degree because the Soviet Union was considered to be analogous to the Nazis. And what I'm worried about in contemporary liberal discourse is that people use this analogy in order to impose what I would say an anti-democratic vision. So do you remember right after the election when there was a cartoon in The New Yorker where there was sort of a guy with a big mustache and he was on a plane and he was saying that I should fly the plane because, you know, don't you trust me, the pilot? We can't trust the pilot. The pilot's the elite and I'm the masses and we should fly the plane. And that's a very dismissive view of what historians call ordinary people. And I think liberals should want to engage with ordinary people as opposed to circumvent them. And by making that existential claim, by making Trump Hitler, by making the present day America Weimar, what they actually do is argue implicitly that this is a extreme times and extreme measures must be taken, and they may in fact be anti-democratic. So you don't want to win people over to your side via political argument or political communication. You just want to get them to vote for you. And this is, I think, indicative of, for example, thinking about citizens not as people but as voters, is that their worth to you is their vote, not engaging with them politically, which I think is endemic to modern liberalism. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I buy and agree with all that, but I would throw in the caveat that much as we talk about, and I think there's actually a pretty direct analogy to make here now that I think about it, much as we talk about the, you know, big Wall Street banks as being too big to fail, and you can kind of look at that two ways. On the one hand, it's kind of true. They are too big to fail. And if you were to just, like, you know, if they had been allowed to fail during the 2008 crisis, the economic havoc that would have resulted would have been unimaginable. And I believe that. But at the same time, if you know, like, the conversation shouldn't end there, even though for, you know, neoliberals and for the Obama administration, it more or less did, Dodd-Frank notwithstanding, you know, the obvious conclusion to draw is, well, okay, so some emergency measure may have to be taken to save the banks right now. But in the process, like, why did we build a system that rests on banks that are too big to fail? And doesn't the existence of banks that are too big to fail, and if they did fail, would wreak such havoc, essentially call for permanent undemocratic power over the economic system, which is clearly the case. And I would say that you can then extend this exact analogy, and you're dealing with a lot of the same policymakers coming from a lot of the same places, to our national security apparatus.
Absolutely.
We've built a global empire. The management of that global empire, a nuclear-armed global empire that can start a major war anywhere in the world at any time, and the management of that empire is a deadly serious task, one that certainly in the near term, I think it's rational, whatever your larger views of U.S. foreign policy are, I think it's rational to want that only entrusted to professionals, even professionals who've made egregious errors and started wars that shouldn't have been started and so on, and not just be entrusted to, you know, democratic whims. But of course, what this suggests is, you know, there's something basically incompatible between having an ostensibly democratic system responsive to the needs of its people and managing an empire on that scale. And I actually want to use this to transition to your article a little bit. So basically, also maybe address the issue of why I did sort of, and sometimes still do, think of Trump as existentially threatening.
Sure.
When Trump was elected, and so to speak, and when it was clear that this was really going to happen, I found it terrifying on just about every front, you know, what it would mean for pretty much anything I've ever cared about. But, you know, I did particularly focus on the most direct power that we give the president, which is to be commander in chief and to order military strikes anywhere in the world with the most powerful weaponry ever created, with nuclear weapons, and even beyond starting wars, you know, the president's ability to destabilize alliances that, you know, whatever one might think of the alliances in the first place, or the countries we're allied with in the first place, Saudi Arabia, the Baltics, whatever, Israel, you know, these alliances are kind of are considered stable, predictable factors in the world. And so I was concerned that just having a president, you know, I was concerned during the election, who might suggest that maybe we wouldn't protect the Baltics, not that we necessarily wouldn't, but maybe we wouldn't, who would create this kind of ambiguity around that ambiguity was itself a major threat, that ambiguity invited, you know, Russia to test the system out, invited potential violence. Now, it's only been a few months. We haven't seen that many tests of this, although I don't want to get into it too much, but the situation in the Persian Gulf now with Qatar is suggestive of where, you know, kind of loose rhetoric might potentially take us, and I can imagine much worse things happening there and elsewhere. But the point is that, you know, I basically felt like, you know, this global empire, this system of alliances, these unsavory alliances in some cases that we've built, our enormous military power, how much of it is concentrated in the executive branch, all of these things I think you and I would critique in exactly the same way. But to me, the immediately scary thing is that someone who is extremely stupid and extremely unstable and doesn't know how any of that is supposed to work at all has been placed in charge. And while I think that proves that the system is dangerously unstable and that we need to work to dismantle it, it also could make even someone like me think, I would feel a lot better short term and would feel a lot better about focusing on grassroots organizing and domestic politics if we could just be sure that whole apparatus is in some stable hands. So I think this was a widespread concern in the first month or two of the Trump presidency. And then we learn he's bringing in Mad Dog Mattis, someone who I don't think liberals were particularly enthusiastic about before the election, but have learned to feel,
stopped
worrying and learned to love. And then also replaced Michael Flynn, a very problematic figure who is, you know, at the center of this whole mishigas around Trump and Russia. Good old Michael Flynn. Replaced him with one H.R. McMaster. And since then, and these are guys that I think John McCain and a lot of kind of mainstream Republican national security hawks and neocons, they really like and respect these guys. And since it became clear that Trump would be working with them, some of the panic that he might just, you know, nuke Pyongyang or Tehran or pull out of NATO abruptly or whatever, some of that has gone away. and people are, you know, resting a little easier and starting to think, well, like, how much damage can Trump do really? I mean, you know, he can pass bad, you know, backward-looking policies. He can do embarrassing things every day, but how much damage can he do really? My concern is, first of all, plenty still. I mean, if he does give just a completely insane order to, you know, nuke or firebomb somewhere, I mean, you know, we're sort of counting on these elites to, you know, stop him somehow. Right. And that's a little scary. But also, I guess it's, you know, even conceding the basic point that we're in somewhat more stable hands, it's probably worth looking into who are these guys exactly.
Right.
And this is where we get to you, because you, and your article, because you, I guess a little over a month ago, had a long piece for the website of N+1, which we'll link to below, where you basically read everything McMaster's ever written in an attempt to figure out what the deal with McMaster is.
Right.
And you had a lot of smart and interesting things to say. And why don't you say them first? Why don't you summarize them?
Sure. Very quickly before I do, I just like to hit home two quick points. Yeah. It's important to be aware of what the empire actually is. And a brilliant historian from Northwestern, a scholar named Daniel Immerwahr, has used the term pointillist empire to describe it, in the sense that there's hundreds of bases, these points of sovereign territory throughout the world that the United States could, from which the United States could project power. So it's important to realize there's actually physical space associated with the empire in foreign territory. I just wanted to underline that very quickly. And then also what you said, what you highlighted about, you do want quote unquote responsible people, even if they had made mistakes in charge of this, I think leads to a fundamental tension in democracy and democratic theory and democratic practice that isn't appreciated, is that there truly is a fundamental tension between expertise and the rule of the people. This tension cannot be completely overcome. It's baked into the cake. But when do you listen to the people and when do you listen to the experts? I would say what you need to ensure, no matter what, is that experts are held accountable. So, for example, if Paul Wolfowitz, just to take a name from random, if Paul Wolfowitz contributes to disastrous decisions, he shouldn't go from the Bush administration to the World Bank to, I think he went to the AEI or one of those.
I think you're skipping over losing his World Bank job because of the affair he was having with.
Yes, not to be prurient, but yes. So to basically move from elite
it's
position,
all local wits. We can say whatever we want. But.
So from elite position to elite position, and then eventually to, you know, Jeb Bush's foreign policy team. And though Jeb exclamation point didn't win, it still shows that the Republican establishment had real faith and Wolfowitz as sort of a thinker. And I think that really sends an awful message to everyone who cares to pay attention, that there's essentially no accountability in our most elite sphere of foreign policymaking.
So you can certainly extrapolate that to the, not to play both sides Fournier style, but you can extrapolate that to staffing up his administration after the OA crisis.
And Larry Summers. I wrote about this in the Washington Post a little bit with a colleague, Matthew Spark. But so I think there's a lack of accountability in our elite spheres that actually points to the corrosion of the system. So even if you accepted that there should be some sort of elite governance, you really need accountability. That's the fundamental thing upon which it rests. And if you actually look at the people who created these systems of governance, they never spoke about accountability, because to them, no matter what, the experts would be wiser than the people. But what Vietnam and Iraq showed is that that's not true. So we need to go back to the drawing board to some degree. So I just want to emphasize that critical point about democratic theory. And I think it's really important to think about in more terms. And if you want to read an interesting book, next April 2018, my book is coming out and it's all about that.
But, we should. Is it available for pre-order? Do you have a title and everything?
I do. It's called Democracy in Exile. You always need the colon, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, which explores these issues in more depth. But well, to get to
I look forward to my signed copy, but
yeah,
but
go, oh, of course. Yeah. I will send you. I was actually thinking of sending Bob Wright a copy, because I've been listening to Blogging Heads for a decade and it's really influenced my way of thinking about the world. So thank you, Bob, if you're listening to this. But anyway, to get to the McMaster piece. So just to give a little background, I did my PhD in history from Duke. McMaster did his PhD in history at UNC. Which is about 15 minutes away, down Tobacco Road, the pleasantly named Tobacco Road. And so there was always a mystique in sort of the history world of the triangle, the Durham-Chapel Hill triangle, about McMaster. You have this brilliant military officer who came, who was brilliant during the Gulf War, who led this great attack during the Battle of 73 Easting, but as a real intellectual, he went to UNC to pursue a master's, loved it so much, got his PhD in the history of the Vietnam War.
Can you just in like a sentence or two say what that battle was?
Sure. So the battle,
piece, but yeah.
Yeah, no problem. So the Battle of 73 Easting, essentially McMaster is in charge of an armored, I'm not a military guy, so I'll probably get this wrong, but an armored unit of some sort that basically massacred a much larger Republican Guard force, an elite force of Iraqi unit, that suffered no casualties.
This is during the first Persian Gulf War.
Gulf War, it was late February 91, and last 2 days, I believe, of the war, and really showed his brilliant tactical mettle, disobeyed order, maybe it's unfair to say disobeyed, but didn't stop at an agreed upon line and showed that some sort of, maybe insouciance is too strong a word, but ability to make your own decisions in the heat of battle was really important and really impressed a lot of people, even though some of his superiors were a little upset at his not having stopped at the agreed upon line. But anyway, then McMaster goes to UNC, studies history, and really becomes a humanist in the sense that in the 90s and beyond, after the Gulf War, there is something called the revolution in military affairs. And the idea was essentially that the increased technological capacities of the United States, the GPS, more effective bombing systems, would really be able to rationalize war in the sense that you could predict war, make it more humane, and have fewer casualties. McMaster, from his intensive reading of military history, really disagreed with this point and made a career, in essence, about being this wise man of foreign affairs, a wise man of military affairs, where he would go against the grain and adopt a humanist perspective about how to fight America's wars that really went against this revolution in military affairs, what one might call a scientistic perspective on war. And he made his career as that. And so there was a lot of respect for McMaster within the intellectual community as a free thinker, as someone who really marched to the beat of his own drummer, et cetera, et cetera. And so when he got into office, I figured that it was probably, correct. I figured that he would have views that maybe I wouldn't necessarily agree with, but that he would be someone who would be competent, who would really be able to make the Trump, to rationalize the Trump administration and make sure that we didn't do anything crazy. So what I wanted to do initially, I pitched this to N+1, was writing a piece that I initially entitled The Intellectual History of H.R. McMaster, to really read everything he's written since 1991 and to see what were his views on the world. And what I found was pretty disheartening. I found someone who was pretty tactically smart in the sense that he understood that if you wanted to nation build it, you wouldn't do it through bombs. You needed to build relationships with local communities, et cetera, et cetera. And these were the strategies that he practiced in this place called Tal Afar in the mid-2000s. And so he built relationships with local communities. He helped.
This is in Iraq.
He's deployed to Iraq. Sorry. Yeah. He holds various positions. He teaches at West Point for a little bit, holds various positions in the 90s, 2000s, eventually deployed to Iraq. And so he's in control of essentially stabilizing this city called Tal Afar. And he does it remarkably successfully, at least at first. Later, the city is taken over by ISIS and is currently, I think, under siege. I haven't checked really in the last month, but is currently under siege and kind of in the territory going back and forth. But he really proved his tactical brilliance might be a bit much, but his tactical capacities to do things that to nation build, which I think is obviously not the greatest thing in the world, but to nation build relatively effectively. So, but when you read his work, you realize he has, or at least I thought he had, a rather naive strategic understanding of the United States' role in the world. And what really jumped out to me, and this may be because of my own scholarly obsession with the interwar period, the 20s, the 30s, and the 30s, which I think a lot of the language through which Americans understand and make foreign policy, that was a decade in which it was created. He really uses the language of good and evil to describe the United States and its enemies versus ISIS and Iran. And what I argued in this piece was that this language implicitly cuts off really deep thinking about what are the United States' interests in the world, what one might call a realistic understanding of the United States' national interest. Because what implicitly happens when you use language like good and evil, and sometimes even use the language of totalitarianism, that to refer to Iran or North Korea as a totalitarian state, is you're implicitly making these countries into existential threats. And what that does is that, again, like the liberals did in the 30s and the 40s, it implies that any measure must be taken to ensure that democracy survives its battle with these existential threats. So you get justifications, implicit and sometimes explicit, for things like the Patriot Act, for things like the USA Freedom Act, for the bombing of Libya, for the continued interventions and actions in Iraq or Afghanistan, and these other, what I would say, strategic blunders, because you're misapprehending the actual threat that these nations pose to the United States. So what I argued is that for all his supposed brilliance, McMaster is very much blinkered by the, what I would call the traditional imperialist view of the United States. And what this shows is that even if you're a brilliant, the way I concluded the piece was that even if you're really a brilliant and to some degree, you know, someone who's willing to go against the grain, a thinker who's willing to buck traditional standards, when you're part of an institution like the American military, which is necessarily dedicated to upholding the American imperial project, there's a significant limit on the type of free thinking that you're able to accomplish. And this, I think, raises really critical questions about whether it's possible to be an officer and an intellectual, or I do think it's possible, but maybe some structural problems that necessarily hold from someone whose view has to be limited by the institution of which they are a part. And I think you see this in the case of McMaster. So yeah, that was my essential take on him.
No, I mean, and that certainly aligns with what I read in the piece. I guess I would want to ask you, first of all, sort of apropos of what we were saying right before this, did you feel, or do you feel, even despite this, even despite knowing that he is this kind of unselfconscious imperialist, that he completely buys into the kind of establishment and kind of hawkish end of the establishment, you know, beltway view of foreign policy, do you nonetheless feel at all reassured that he and not, for instance, Michael Flynn or, I don't know, Jared Kushner has such a central role in shaping Trump's national security policy? I mean, not as sort of the ideal person you would want to if you could pick anyone, but, you know, given the circumstances in which we find ourselves, is there any value to having a kind of, you know, competent conventional thinker at the helm, advising the president?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's a little complex. So I actually also reviewed Flynn's tract manifesto, co-written with Michael Ledeen, The Field of Fight for Dissent. And what actually struck me, and I also read a lot of Bannon stuff for another piece, but what struck me about McMaster's strategic vision, and as it compared with Flynn and Bannon's, is that it was remarkably similar. Hmm. That they both framed ISIS as this existential threat. They both framed Iran as this sort of country that you couldn't really deal with. And it was remarkably, even so, what McMaster doesn't do is he doesn't use the language of the class of civilizations. That's a big difference. Flynn and Bannon employ this trope made famous by Samuel Huntington in the 1990s about the United States facing this class of civilizations with either the Arab, but really the Islamic world. And McMaster doesn't do that. McMaster has much more of a liberal sensibility about respecting other religions and things along those lines. But in the end, he really
possibly shaped by his experiences in nation.
Definitely.
Far, right. He actually knows the Iraqis and knows what works and what doesn't, and right, has had to apprehend them as a society. But
it's not imperialism with a human face. It's sort of the subjugated have a human face for him in a way that they don't for Flynn and Bannon. But still, in the end, he still uses this 30s framework of good and evil to understand international relations. So I, for one, was never particularly concerned about Trump blundering into a nuclear war. Hopefully in 6 months, this doesn't prove me wrong, but I guess we'll not. We wouldn't be around, so who cares anyway. But
What did you imagine would check? I mean, I never thought he would blunder us into total annihilation. I thought he might get some idea into his head, like let's nuke Raqqa in, you know, I hope he's not listening to this. I'm sure he's not. He has no attention span. But, you know, let's nuke Raqqa and take out ISIS that way. I mean, they don't have a nuclear deterrent. They don't have a great power backing them. And let's show them who's boss. And he'd had this, you know, incendiary rhetoric. So for that matter, I think Ted Cruz had talked about, you know, turning the sand in Iraq into glass or something like that. I don't know. What if they decided to use a tactical nuke against ISIS, which would be, you know, unprecedented in the history of post-1945 warfare, you know, just to show who's boss. And let's say Trump got that into his head one day. And, you know, he's certainly gotten all kinds of things into his head. What would you imagine would, and were he to do that, I think it would not start. I mean, I think we have this concept of nuclear war that comes out of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on, and is almost totally abstracted. It's like you know, we fire our missiles, the Soviets fire theirs, humanity is wiped out, you know, Right. Someone in New Zealand.
End of story.
Right. And that's what we think of. And in talking about it that way, we make nuclear war unthinkable. But right. I worry, no, what if he blows up Raqqa, kills, you know, I don't know how many people live there, 200,000 people, something like that. You know, there's no obvious deterrent power, but then maybe Russia decides they have to nuke a city controlled by the Nusra Front or something, just to prove that they can do that too. Or China has to prove somewhere that they can do it too.
Right.
Or Iran, you know, and Saudi and all these other countries rush to get bombs. I mean, you could imagine, I mean, to say nothing of the horror itself of killing everyone in Raqqa.
Right.
These are situations that genuinely freak me out, because I wonder what exactly is going to stop that from happening if Trump like feels like it someday.
And
let's say it weren't McMaster. Let's say it were Flynn. Let's say that we're talking about this from the point of view of January 20th. How do you imagine something like that, or maybe not even nukes, maybe just like horrific? I mean, he's already ramped up he's already basically told the military, you're allowed to inflict more civilian casualties in Yemen and Iraq. What do you imagine will check him from doing things that even by recent standards are really horrifying and destabilizing?
So I think the critical question, I guess this is a question of faith. There's no way to really go for or against it, but I just didn't think he would ever actually use nuclear weapons. That's just an enormous norm to have broken. I don't think
maybe breaks norms every day.
Sure. Yeah. That might be a different quality, and no one would know until it happened, of course. But I guess I assume that the security establishment, the foreign policy, military establishment, essentially wouldn't have let that happen. Maybe
would
that's
they,
wrong.
Would they refuse a direct order from the commander in chief?
I think they might. I think in that situation, I legitimately think they might. I think to break the nuclear norm would be such an enormous shift in international politics. I think there might actually be, and of course,
what's interesting is that's a pretty profound faith in experts and institutions that you're expressing there, which I think you're probably right, but that does go in tension with, you know, isn't he the elected leader of the American people? Shouldn't he be able to do whatever he wants?
This is the tension at the heart of democracy. You need experts. Right. I'm not saying you don't need experts. The question is, how do you make them accountable and how do you make them give good advice? Right. I'm not anti-enlightenment as some of the original realists were. And we could have another conversation about realism, which I think is often a misused term. But that's neither here nor there. So I would say in other regards, for example, like the civilian casualties or things along those lines, I mean, McMaster is not that different from Flynn. In a book review written about a book on ISIS, McMaster essentially calls for multi-generational occupation of the Middle East to ensure that no threats to American power, you know, could possibly arise. How is that different from Flynn? Not much. You know, right. I think Flynn is different.
Or Hillary Clinton, really.
Or Hillary Clinton.
Advising her. But,
so this is why I want to stress, I think in some areas it's important to stress the continuity, like Trump, not as a break, but as a continuity, and just revealing that the emperor has no clothes, and particularly in foreign and security policy and military policy. He's just, I think I said in the piece, Trump represents the same, but more amateurishly executed. So you could see the machinations, sort of the foolishness behind the entire premise, because Trump is just saying, he's just using simple language to explain things that have been obscured in more technical and language
and
jargon.
Well, and it's interesting because this point, which there's probably something to, but it veers it veers in the direction of my previous Blogging Heads interlocutor and longtime nemesis on Twitter, Michael Tracy, aka the Sunglasses Man, who had quite a week for himself, but never mind that with the Maxine Waters incident. But you know, I think you don't allude to him personally, but maybe to the general vein of thought that he represents in the piece when you briefly mentioned that there were some on both the left and the right. I think he identifies more with the left, but there's some interesting crossover there. Who sort of hoped going into the election or after that, maybe Trump, you know, however ill-advised some of his comments were, maybe he would actually take us in a less imperialist direction. Right. And it's fair to say, and I'll actually give Michael credit, he himself has said on more than one occasion, including my conversation with him, that didn't pan out. And that, in fact, Trump is running a conventionally interventionist, you know, well within the parameters set by the previous several presidents or what we could have expected from Hillary Clinton or Mitt Romney or John McCain.
Right. I guess it's not surprising that a guy who doesn't know much and doesn't care to know much would listen to the people who are around him who assert their authority. You know, I mean, it's not particularly surprising to me. And it's just he sort of goes along with the flow in this regard, as every president has more or less actively since 1940, let's say 47, with the Truman Doctrine speech. People have gone along with this vein. And what's sad as a historian is that the past 16 years of events haven't forced the elite to reconceive their notions. And I think what's important here to understand is that this is also a little bit of a structural issue in American politics, where many of the leaders of the party are quite old. McCain, Trump himself, Dianne Feinstein, Nancy Pelosi, even Elizabeth Warren, Hillary, Bernie.
Joe Biden. They're all super old.
They're all super old. And a colleague of mine used a great phrase. They have Soviet ages. You know, it's that like people whose historical experience was completely shaped by the Cold War in a completely different geopolitical context are still making policy.
It's funny. I actually read Soviet ages slightly differently. That's true, too. But I was thinking more about how prior to Gorbachev's reforms in the Soviet system, they had three successive, septuagenarian or octogenarian rulers who were, you know, products of the revolutionary generation, basically. And it spoke to the just total stagnation of the system.
Exactly. It doesn't speak well for the system at all. And I think it would be wise for the polity as a whole. I don't have a particular strategy to this, for the polity as a whole to take people who have had different historical experiences and different understandings of the geopolitical context into account, why not into the National Security Council?
Though what we've seen, by the way, is that, you know, Barack Obama, who, you know, didn't support the Iraq War and did have a few new ideas, I think, or wanted to push on things he had, you know, notwithstanding whatever Trump might do to them now, I mean, you know, the Cuba and Iran deal policies, and he definitely did.
That's fair.
All people talk about drones and continuity and everything. He definitely did push some of the left edges of what the blob would allow through Ben Rhodes, who was in a younger generation too.
Just a question: is he one of the podcast the Saving America?
No, he's not actually. But he is active on Twitter and like a lot of former Obama.
I know who he is. I thought he was associated with that. But
no, he's not. Ben Rhodes. I actually have a deep fascination with Ben Rhodes. I think he's well, but anyway, let's not get into that now. But there are people who like him or. Like there is a new generation of policymakers and there's a new generation of politicians. Most of Warren, you know, notwithstanding most of the names being circulated for the Democrats in 2020 are Gen Xers. Finally, you know, people like Gillibrand and Harris and Booker and so on. But it's actually remarkable how to the extent they've thought about foreign policy at all, which generally isn't much, how conventional their thinking is too. And how conventional their Republican generational counterparts like Tom Cotton or Marco Rubio are.
Spence, right?
Yeah. The only member of the Senate right now who really does seem interested in pushing foreign policy in a somewhat more leftward direction, and not just on one or two issues, but like actually has a new way of thinking about it, is the Democratic senator from Connecticut, Chris Murphy, who's also a Gen Xer, and who I think is he doesn't seem at first like he'd be a fascinating figure. He seems like a pretty conventional white dude from Connecticut. But on this particular subject, I think he deserves a lot of credit for. And actually, my friend Eric Levitz at New York Magazine did a long interview with him for that, where he fleshed out some of his views. And you know, he's not a bomb thrower at all, but he's definitely thinking in a different way. He's one of the only politicians on the scale that he is who's talking as if like there has been a fundamental bipartisan problem with how foreign policy has been made for the last generation, and something, you know, sustained needs to change. And I think this will bring us to another thing we wanted to discuss and talked about at the beginning some, which is, basically, it sounds like you, me, maybe Bob Wright, maybe Chris Murphy, maybe a lot of people I know would all like there to be more robust and decidedly progressive foreign policy institutions, magazines, journals, think tanks. You know, we can name individual people who we think are experts or are thinking in the right way about things, and you could well be one of them. But there is just not a structure. I mean, the way there is for kind of Clinton and Obama era interventionist liberals, Wilsonians, or for neocons, or even for conservative realists. We just don't have the same kind of institutional support. So why do you think that is, sort of historically speaking, and you know, but into the present, and what would it take to get us there? And do you have any big ideas you'd like to debut here?
Yeah, right. Well, I think historically there's two major reasons. First, the first real think tank, Council on Foreign Relations, emerges from World War I, the Inquiry, Woodrow Wilson. And this is a totally establishment, elite level affair, foundations, basically New York, what would be called the Boswash Corridor, now making foreign policy. They were internationalists. They were business people. They wanted free trade globally. And so this is a very establishmentarian perspective for one strand of the origins of think tanks in American history. The other strand is that when think tanks really take off, it's with the Rand Corporation and its offspring in the late 1940s. And this is very much a Cold War think tank, where, again, what I talked about earlier, the idea of this existential threat in the Soviet Union mirroring the Nazis, and you needed to have a muscular foreign policy in order to combat it. They never thought of it as imperial. They thought of it as muscular. And I think that sort of institutional inertia has really lasted since the late 1940s and early 1950s. The idea that these institutions were created literally to promote and expand what we would today call American empire, right? So there's a very limited purview and what's acceptable discourse at a place like the Council on Foreign Relations or at a place like the Brookings Institution. So you might say, someone, Brookings, to succeed at Brookings, what type of vision do you have? Someone like myself would never get invited to be an analyst at Brookings, right? You need to have a quote-unquote internationalist perspective, someone that promotes American leadership, what might be called the American liberal international order, as Tom Wright calls it in a recent book, and he's at Brookings about it. And so these institutions necessarily limit what type of views are allowed into them. So that's one problem on the institution's half. The second, I'll talk about the left because I know it more, because Cato arguably does have a semi-robust anti-imperialist foreign policy vision where it's not all, but so that's on the right, and I could talk a little bit about that, but the left.
And actually, I should say, the Center for American Progress was kind of teasing one for a while during parts of the Obama administration, and several people I know, including Ali Gharib, Zed Jilani, Li Fang, Eli Clifton, like there was this whole cohort that were there who I think Fez Shakir had brought in, and they were, you know, on the Think Progress blog, they were like regularly inveighing against, you know, U.S. imperial designs on Iran or, you know, the treatment of Palestine from like a decidedly left perspective. And there was a whole blow up, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, you know, where Ben Smith at Politico at the time, now he's the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, you know, wrote a post that was kind of informed by some neocons he knew, basically saying, like, what is the deal with Think Progress? Why do they have this this right. in-house left cohort. And I remember, like, it sort of turned into open war between Glenn Greenwald and Neera Tanden and right. Eli Lake and all these. And it's never really ended. I feel like all these people still hate each other. I mean, I guess they probably did before, too. But basically, like, a lot of that left. Like, and I think going into the Clinton administration, the perspective of what right. would have essentially been the Clinton administration's in-house think tank, you know, had to be internationalist, had to be interventionist. Right. You know, obviously had to care about confronting Russia and Assad and so on. So yeah, it was like there was kind of an experiment with could you do that in the mainstream Democratic Party, and it seems to have
turns
been
out no.
Yeah.
So I think and then I think it leads to the question of why doesn't the left have a para institutional structure?
Yeah.
And there are several reasons for that. One, the left hasn't governed pretty much ever. The closest it came was Debs. So the left has always been a rump party. And has always been more interested in critique than promoting a positive vision because it's never really had political power in the United States in the 20th century.
Yeah. I should say on that note also that one person who was, and I'm not sure if he still is at Think Progress and is a regular Blogging Heads host or has been in the past, Matt Duss.
Yes. UW graduate.
Yeah, and Bernie Sanders' foreign policy advisor, kind of informally, as was his co-host of Foreign Entanglements on this site, Robert Farley. So never let it be said that Blogging Heads lacks influence. Had Bernie Sanders won, and we all know Bernie would have won, had Bernie Sanders actually won, it's entirely possible that two very long time Blogging Heads hosts would have played a role in shaping his foreign policy. But I digress, but I think that's worth noting. Bernie, of course, never seemed to care that much about foreign policy at all. Yeah. But to the extent that he did, I would say had you know, well left of center views on interventionism. And this occasionally, I mean, there was a beautiful moment in one of the Democratic primary debates where he called out Hillary Clinton for her, you know, touting her friendship with Henry Kissinger. And it was awesome. It was like, finally, like someone operating at this level willing to say Henry Kissinger is bad.
But then
I would wonder, like, well, let's say he did make it and it's conceivable he could have, or let's say someone who is, you know, aligned with him and has the support of his supporters does become president, which could conceivably happen in 2020 or, you know, not that long from now. Who's going to advise that person? I mean, maybe not us. But,
yeah. Well, I mean, Matt Brunig is doing some good work with his new think tank.
But on policy stuff specifically?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like he might be interested in that. I don't want to speak for him, but it seems like he might be interested in that going forward. But I think so the first problem with the left is it's never governed, so it's never had this sort of capacity. But also, there's always been a focus on the left, and I think rightly, to some degree, about people power. So the focus was always on building grassroots organizations and winning grassroots power. And there's been a much more, historically at least, there's been much more skepticism about engaging in elite level politics, which is essentially what think tanks are. Think tanks really bring one element of the elite intellectuals to another element of the elite decision makers. And this is especially in the 60s, you know, don't trust anyone over 30, that sort of rhetoric. You know, you can't trust anyone in the establishment. To be in the think tank is to be, to some degree, a member of the establishment. So there was always a reticence about that historically among the left. And it's a little sad to me because when you compare it to libertarianism, so libertarianism is a radical philosophy in the 40s and the 50s. You know, no one would have been caught dead reading Ayn Rand in the 50s or the 60s and pronouncing it like Paul Ryan does today.
Yeah.
But what libertarians did was over the course of the 60s, 70s, and 80s was very consciously to build a movement to have policy of influence. And so they found Cato in 77, which according to James McGann's think tank report has been one of the most influential think tanks in Washington. Right. So that sort of reticence about engaging in elite level politics, I think, has harmed the left. And I believe our generation is getting over that for a variety of reasons, probably most importantly, 9/11 in 2008. And the 2008 recession showed that the state matters and policy matters. And so we're getting over that, but this is a reason why there's not these sort of parastate institutions that could really inform the entire Center for American Progress establishment was like gearing up to take positions in the Hillary administration, and there was no equivalent for Bernie. But I think that's beginning to change. And also there's some problems with this is that the left doesn't have easy access to billionaires able to fund it because the left is skeptical of capitalism.
Right.
You know, and even anti-capitalists. So the people who would actually fund these sorts of parastate structures don't want to support it. There's no Koch brothers. There's no Soros.
Right.
You know, who's the lefty? Who's the lefty Soros? And let's not even go Koch brothers. I can't think of one. You know, is there?
I have some names, but I don't feel like I can float them.
Right.
But maybe they might exist, though probably not on the level of Soros.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I, while I think there's huge room for it to be better, and actually just last night on Twitter, my friend Sean McElwee, who's a progressive policy analyst, very young at Demos, started a big and interesting thread that, you know, Chris Hayes and others got involved in, that was basically about this exact problem. And Sean's not a foreign policy wonk himself, but he was asking this exact question, basically, where are the institutions? Where is the structure? Who's going to do this? And it's funny, like, I keep thinking there's sort of two natural constituencies for the actual expert base. One is, I think there are probably a lot of people who actually have worked within the system and have worked in liberal administrations and the Obama administration, maybe someone like the aforementioned Ben Rhodes, who chafe against, like, who know that, you know, the status quo with Israel is completely unacceptable.
Right.
Who know that, like, the Iran deal was a very good idea and you know, pushed for it. Who knew about opening Cuba, you know, who generally want a stronger State Department and a, you know, less Pentagon, less CIA, you know, but who you know, have also maybe in some views on the left been tainted by their involvement in an actual administration that did things like drone strikes or the Libya intervention or
right.
or what have you, or the you know, NSA spying. So there's that. There's kind of you know, the very liberal end of the blob who I think by themselves could use a much stronger representation than they have, and you know, who aren't tainted by having supported the Iraq War, for
right.
instance, because as so many Democrats are. And then there's also, I think, people who don't have a lot of policy experience per se, and who are much more avowedly left, but what they do have is real international experience. They've
right.
spent time in other countries. They've learned languages. They've studied in academia. You know, you would obviously qualify. But you know, I mean, because I feel like I definitely do know people who've like lived in Cairo. They've lived in Moscow. They've lived in Latin America, and these places are not abstract to them.
Right.
And I often feel like they know what they're talking about much more than the people
right.
you see on TV who are supposedly experts do. But there's just nothing that is kind of anchoring them into the policymaking apparatus. And I do
right.
think you're right that to some extent this is hostility from the establishment and a lack of money behind it. But a lot of it really does fall on the left, and it's just
absolutely
reflexive yeah. resistance to anything resembling policymaking. And I'll get into arguments with avowedly left people, you know, certainly over the Russia scandal, which I don't want to get into here, but you know, we're learning new things every day. But
horror show.
But very good. But but like but stuff of that nature, where, you know, there are some valid left critiques of, you know,
yes.
what the establishment is saying about these things, but like clearly they haven't thought at all. People in, you know, the Intercept universe or whatever, about what a, you know, how you actually would run a U.S.-Russia foreign policy, what you would do if you, you know, did try to, you know, cut some deal with Putin and then he screwed you. How would you react then? Are there circumstances where you would support sanctions? And I just don't, I see so few people who are on the left remotely capable of thinking in these terms.
They don't, or wrestling with those questions.
Yeah, they don't want to because they don't expect to govern themselves.
Right, exactly.
And because they, on some level, you know, and this traces back to what we've been talking about all along, they don't really see the current American empire as legitimate, which I understand, but that doesn't absolve Americans who almost by definition have benefited from it. Certainly if you're doing okay in this country and you haven't been, you know, amputated in a foreign war, you're almost certainly a beneficiary of the empire, whether you want to be or not. It doesn't absolve us of the responsibility of, let's say, managing the graceful decline, which was
right.
rhetoric that I thought Obama himself sometimes often indulged in and sometimes completely flew in the face of. But But yeah, I mean, like, I definitely think like the left can't just
right.
You know, were Bernie Sanders to become president, he would in fact be entrusted with managing this empire.
Right. I totally
yeah. to wind it down, and we need to have really like smart ideas about how to do that.
I think what you're saying. Well, first of all, I want to say I don't want to impugn The Intercept. I think Greenwald and Scahill do crucial work.
I didn't mean to either. I know.
No, for sure. I think they're very, very important. But I think the way what you're really saying is that the left doesn't currently have a positive vision of foreign policy. And the way that I would phrase it is that anti-imperialism is not a foreign policy. Anti-imperialism. Hold on, David, I can't hear you. Are you?
You can't hear me?
Oh, now I hear you. Okay, great. Yeah. So sorry. So anti-imperialism is really not a foreign policy. It's a critique. And so what I think you're right. I think let's say what is our utopia? A world without hierarchy, right? Let's just say broadly speaking, a world without hierarchy where the means of production are owned by the people who aren't. Okay, et cetera, et cetera. But
well, a critique of global neoliberal capitalism, right?
Right. Of course. Like
a world without hierarchy is a world that is not just at peace across borders, but and within borders, but also a world that's not basically run by transnational elites, plutocrats. Which is why, like, when I look at Russia, I don't see essentially, you know, the heir to the Soviet Union, where every debate about U.S.-Russia relations is a rehash of the 1950s and McCarthyism. I see a country that is actually like a case study in how badly neoliberal capitalism is working out for the world, a country, you know, where the standard of living dropped after the end of the Soviet Union, where, you know, there's grotesque inequality, and where the ruling elite, in addition to committing all kinds of, you know, human rights abuses at home, and sometimes in other countries like Syria or Ukraine, you know, also park their money in London and Manhattan real estate and are basically
Seattle real estate
or Seattle real estate or for that matter, you know, like what does Secretary of State Rex Tillerson represent? He represents ExxonMobil's desire to, you know, normalize relations with Russia so that they can hasten the destruction of the planet while, you know, profiting in the hundreds of billions in the Arctic Circle. I mean, to me, these are left critiques. Like, these are things the left needs, but to make them, you have to, you know, you have to be willing to criticize Russia in public, basically.
Well, even beyond Russia, which is, I think, not crucial here, it's like, those are critiques, but what's the positive vision? So how do we get from here to there? First things first, you need to win political power. So I was talking to a very good friend of mine during the strikes on Syria, and she said something along the lines of, what do we do? And the answer is, you get in power. If you don't get power, it does not matter. All of our critiques, all of our moralism, it does not matter. So that's step one. Step one is actually winning elections in this country. I'm very skeptical of the revolutionary alternative. I do not think there should be a revolution. We should win elections. So that's number one. But then once we win elections, hopefully, I think there's actually a moment where the actual left could actually win actual elections. Once that happens, what is our vision of the world? And I think right now we need to move. Now is the time for our generation specifically to move beyond critique and develop a positive program of how we get from here to there. Right. And what we need to do, this isn't something that some singular Einstein is going to be able to do. We need to meet. We need to organize. We need to do it beyond Twitter jokes, which are great. I love Twitter jokes. They're fantastic. They're the best. Even though every time I tweet, I lose a follower. So that's,
you know, you clear a threshold where where you start gaining more than you lose, but it takes
a while. Right. Yeah. So for sure. But we need to really organize in places where people who have the, frankly, the leisure, the luxury to be able to sit and think about these issues, get together and really think about these issues. And I think, again, just to what I was saying earlier, that's what Matt Brunig's doing. That's what even a podcast like Chapo Trap House is doing. You know, it's a fantastic podcast.
I love those guys dearly and I love their podcast. But although I think they actually have brought on like Jeremy Scahill and other people and had some very salient critiques of existing, you know, U.S. Mideast policy. But I wouldn't say I any of them are in the vanguard for policy making.
No, but what's important about a podcast like Chapo is that it shows the world that there are people who agree with you and that what you're thinking is not ridiculous.
Yes.
That just calling out American foreign policy as immoral and at points disgusting is a really important rhetorical move to make, because it allows people from Iowa to Seattle to LA to realize that they're not alone. So that's one element and the whole podcast phenomenon. But now we need to use the energy that's come in the wake of Trump's election, where it really shows that the emperor has no clothes, and use that to come together to develop a positive vision. And this is what I think the left needs to do. Too often people say we need to do X or Y. Now, of course, politics is an exercise in hierarchy and arbitrage, and you need to decide what you do now and what you don't do later. But I think so I study the 1920s social democrats in my own work. And what's really interesting is that they had a very conscious program about what different types of people are able to contribute to the movement. So I'm not the best organizer. You know, I'm an awkward academic. I'm good at thinking about things. Whereas organizers...
You're likable enough, Daniel.
I'm like... thank you, David. But I think that... So we need to think more consciously about political strategy. So what does someone like me do for the movement? What does a labor organizer do for a movement? What does a worker do for a movement? What does the podcast host do for the movement? Right. And what we need to think in these very large holistic terms, because in my opinion, we might actually be able to we might actually be able to win political power in the United States at this historical moment. The system has been shown to not be what everyone thought it was. So we need to work together beyond these discussions about identity politics versus class politics, et cetera. We need to think about political strategy. That is the number one goal of the current left, in my opinion.
Or put another way, and I swear this thought just popped into my head now, I hope it comes out well, we need to seize the means of policy production.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a great way of thinking about it. And we need to start with
trademark David Kleon, June 2017. But yeah.
No, I mean, basically, academia cannot be our center.
Right.
You know, the labor
start.
Movement.
It's a good reserve. Start. I mean, it's what's the term? Like a farm system for the policy apparatus. But I could see someone exactly like you, you know, going from, you know, the University of Washington to Washington, D.C., but it would be great if you could have a perch on the way, if you didn't have to wait till someone's actually elected. Because I do sort of have this image that in the alternate reality where Bernie won, as we know he would have, suddenly, maybe he does pick some eclectic left-leaning policy advisors, and then he basically gets bum-rushed by the blob,
right.
And suddenly he's taking advice from Samantha Power or whoever.
Right, exactly.
Or Madeleine Albright, I don't know. You're right. We need to be prepared for that before it happens. I think we've been going on for an hour and a half now.
Yeah, this is a long one.
Yeah, we had another unrelated topic, but I think we should save it for another time.
I agree.
But this was great. This is, I think, really illuminating. I'd love to do this again sometime.
That's great.
Yeah. And I think everyone should follow Daniel. Because he's you've actually been writing a lot for a lot of like real outlets recently, and people and people should see what you have to say. I think that this conversation, especially this last thing we're talking about with left foreign policy making, is not the work of one dialogue or one tweet storm. This is the work of a lifetime. So.
Right. Or two tweet storms, at least.
Two tweet storms, possibly even. So anything, I'll give you the last word. Anything you'd like to say?
No, just I would like to say thank you to Blogging Heads. I think they really provide an important service, and I hope they continue well into the future.
Yes, same, obviously. All right. Well, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, David. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.